finance, maybe for FOIA requests or something.
What some people don't know, there are literally caves full of government payroll. Yes. Literally caves.
Literally caves.
I want to see
decommissioned coal mines. Yeah. Hello and welcome back to Wonkcast. This is our Below the Fold segment held every Monday. Glad to have you here with us, listener. My name's Eric Ledoux. I'll be your host for this evening.
Yep.
And with me are Eli Richmond.
Hello.
And Catherine Lundy.
Hi.
So, Kat, Eli, we're here to discuss something that happened in the news, Below the Fold, that some of our dear listeners may have missed from the past week.
Yeah.
What do you have for us today?
So I brought the Medicare buy-in bill that Senators Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Jeff Merkley of Oregon sponsored last week.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sponsored this bill, the Choose Medicare Act, which is a Medicare buy-in program, so people who are not over 65 and therefore eligible for Medicare would be able to pay a premium and get health insurance through the Medicare program and be able to use Medicare's buying and negotiating power in order to get lower prices, just like any other Medicare patient does. The thing is that this is the fourth Democratic healthcare bill relating to Medicare that's been sponsored this Congress. So there's this Medicare buying plan. There's a Kaine-Bennett Medicare buying plan. There's a buy-in plan that Brian Schatz wrote, and then there's Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan. So one big takeaway here is that like healthcare is definitely going to be an issue in the 2020 election. Like all of the likely Democratic candidates are talking about it, are pushing their own healthcare bills, their own healthcare plans. So that's something that we're definitely going to be seeing dominate the agenda for a while. But I also just want to talk about this specific buy-in plan and how it differs from some of the other buy-in plans out there. So this one is fairly straightforward. It uses the ACA subsidies. First of all, bumps those up a little bit so that people would be able to save a little bit more money with the subsidies. That would give everybody enough money to buy a gold plan, whereas right now they give enough money to buy a silver plan.
Mm-hmm.
I would also expand those subsidies from 400 to 600% of the poverty line, and people would be able to use those subsidies to pay for their premiums in their Medicare plan. So this does differ from the other buy-in plans that are out there. Under the Kaine-Bennett plan, employers could buy into Medicare. So instead of an employer going and buying a private plan for their employees, they would be able to pay a lump sum to get all of their employees on Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
So that part wasn't in Murphy and Merkley's bill, but Merkley and Murphy's bill had more subsidies than the Kaine-Bennett plan. The proposal by Brian Schatz, meanwhile, allows entire states to buy into Medicare. So it's trying to take this idea that some states like California, Vermont have tried, and that is putting their own like state-based version of a single-payer option, but instead putting those states in the larger federal Medicare plan. So one concern about this is also the idea's main strength, which is currently Medicare has a lot of negotiating power, and they're able to convince providers to take lower prices because they're able to say, well, we're giving you this this reliable pool of patients that you're going to be seeing a lot. If a lot more people are on Medicare, we could see a situation where some providers decide to stop taking it because they don't see it as good a deal for themselves, because they wouldn't have as many younger patients who had higher paying insurance plans.
Mm.
But of course, there are single payer plans in many advanced economies throughout the world, And while you have providers in those countries that don't take their country's single-payer money, it's not like a serious problem in those countries. They still have plenty of providers who are willing to take the money that they're given from their single-payer program and give services just fine. So that's a concern that's often raised, but it's unclear how much it would really play out.
So I just want to clarify, buy-in, when we call the system a buy-in system, what it is it's, you know, you offering to pay into Medicare in exchange for it being your primary insurance.
Yeah.
Okay.
So kind of taking a smaller view of what we look at as single payer, whereas like when Bernie Sanders comes out and talks about Medicare for All, he's talking about the government taking care of every citizen and making sure that that's not something that people are concerning themselves with, how to get their own insurance. The Medicare buy-in plan, you still need to do that. You're going out on the insurance marketplace and buying your own insurance just like you do now. It's just that now there's a public option. There's this Medicare buy-in option. And that might turn out, it'll probably turn out to be cheaper because Medicare has this great negotiating power and it's able to pay providers much less than private insurance companies do. And if that's the case, if the premiums are a lot lower, then you'll see people flocking to it pretty quickly.
So when people talk about some providers deciding to not accept Medicare, what they're talking about is when providers think that they're not making enough to pay for whatever their overhead costs are. Is that what it is? Or is it just like what they're missing out on is, like, is it like when you accept Medicare for these providers, does it at least cover what their overhead cost is? Or are they just saying, I don't want to take this unless I can make a huge profit off of it?
I think it's usually the latter.
Okay.
A lot of the providers who don't want to accept Medicare, and actually there's a pretty small group of providers that won't accept Medicare. There's a much larger group of providers that won't accept Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that people at Medicaid face a lot, is that their networks of available providers is much smaller than people on private insurance. And that's usually because the people who won't take the public plans are specialists that charge a lot for procedures, and also, I don't really know what to call it, it's not like unnecessary medicine, but you know, there's a certain field of specialists who it's not life or death. Plastic surgeons is the most obvious example, but I don't think you can pay for that with private insurance anyway.
I will say that I am a supporter of this plan because it does not have the same sort of immigration restrictions like the ACA has. One of the biggest fights, or at least in terms of immigration fights or immigrant rights fights, was the ability for certain types of people with certain status to be able to get health care through the federal government, and this plan does not have those restrictions, the same restrictions as the ACA, which opens up health care to some of these underserved groups.
Okay, wait, so you're saying that the ACA had more restrictions than
more
this plan does?
Yes, more restrictions in terms of who is eligible to access this health care.
Yeah, I remember that being a point in the 2016 Democratic primaries. There was some debate about whether to provide the Obamacare subsidies to undocumented immigrants.
It was also a way to get more people in the market, especially if they're totally willing to spend their money and be part of.
Yeah, at all.
Yeah, I mean, this is one where like it becomes impossible to separate politics away from policy. And you know, obviously, I don't want to take the view that immigrants don't deserve the social welfare somehow, but I guess I understand from like a fairness perspective, but I don't understand it from a like human decency perspective.
Well, I feel like if it's a plan you pay into, let's say we have Medicare and it turns into this system where everyone can just pay in, anyone who wants to pay into it can get that insurance, then what does it matter what your immigration status is? If you pay into it, you're part of the pot now. How's that any different than a private insurance?
Just to continue sort of playing devil's advocate, I think there is, first of all, a lot of people don't see it that way. A lot of people see these programs as inherently being like the government giving something to you instead of you getting a service that you're also paying for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's also a view that may come into play more strongly with their current Medicare system than with the Medicare buy-in system, like when we're talking about, where people might see immigrants who haven't been paying into this system throughout their lives, then moving into the U.S. and then being able to take advantage of services. Again, I don't really have a problem with that. I think it's fine. But my understanding is that conservatives find that to be unfair on kind of a visceral level. They say, like, I've been paying for this program my whole life.
But isn't it the same as, like, I thought it was the same as, and I could be totally wrong, but this, I thought it was kind of the same as Social Security. Like, when I give money to Social Security, it's not that I get to access these funds later. This is money that's already being distributed out.
Yeah.
And then, like, you've earned a certain amount for distribution to you later on in life.
Okay.
Right. So, I mean, that gets to the point of it right there. Like, those are the two different views of Social Security. And I think a lot of Americans have become acceptable, have started to accept Social Security on the basis of viewing it as, I am paying into this system now and I'm going to get that money back later. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the way we talk about Social Security is very much in that sense. We're being like, oh, you know, you're saving money for the future. You're going to get that money back. And we're not really doing the best service to possible consumers there, because really what's happening is no one's seeing the Social Security money that they put in come back to them. The money they're getting is coming from new Social Security taxpayers.
Yeah, it's not put in an account, invested or something.
Definitely not. And that's a different policy structure. It's one that some economies have adopted, like Chile, but it's definitely not the one we have, but still a lot of people think about it that way.
Yeah, but really it comes down to, like, the most controversial thing about this with buying into Medicare or any other sort of program where funds are used to provide a service to people is who deserves to receive that service, and that's where most of the controversy is.
Definitely. But I don't know, maybe something like a Medicare buy-in could help diminish that feeling a little bit, because it's less I'm just receiving free medical care, and more like, no, I'm paying a premium. I'm paying for this service.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great. Thank you, Eli, for sharing that. Kat?
Today, I'm going to talk about public charge, which is also related to healthcare and immigrants, so it kind of flows a little bit smoothly. So a year ago, there was a leak by Vox that discussed new proposals from the Department of Homeland Security. Yes, the Department of Homeland Security, and how they were going to evaluate applicants in what they call the totality of circumstances. You have the totality of circumstances, your education, your job, what you can contribute. Sometimes it's the quality of your health coming in. So with the totality of circumstances, they want to add this new provision that expands on what a term is called public charge. Public charge historically has always referred to whether or not a immigrant coming into the United States may become a charge, like think of like a credit card charge, on the United States economy. For instance, SSI, or Supplemental Social Insurance, which is a long-term public benefits program. If they felt that you were going to be using benefits for the long term, that would be a criteria for refusal for your application to come to the United States or to get a LPR, long permanent resident status, or green card, as most people call it. Now the Trump administration, or Department of Homeland Security, wants to expand this to not just have long-term social or public benefit programs, but they want to expand it to programs like, and this is still just a draft, they don't know what the final programs will be, but it's currently the proposed rule is at OMB right now, so it could literally come out tomorrow. In the leaked draft that came out last month, they had SNAP, they had WIC, they had things like housing vouchers, they had things like subsidized health insurance, they earned income tax credits, energy benefits. So on top of them including these as part of the public charge in your application, not only that is they're adding this new element of sponsor liability, meaning that if, say, you are a mother in the United States with a U.S.-born, U.S. citizen child, if you had a husband that lived in Norway or South Africa or Mexico, and you wanted to sponsor him coming into the United States, your child's use of WIC or CHIP or any of these benefits that your child is legally allowed and is eligible for would count against her own father coming into the United States. So we see this as this really, really wonky way that the Trump administration is trying to cut what he has called chain migration, but what us in the advocacy field like to call family-based immigration. So it's a really, really wonky way of achieving this, because the way he's doing it is through executive directive. He's basically telling Homeland Security to create this proposed rule chain, which goes to the Office of Management Budget, and then the only thing that we have to sort of combat this would be to flood the public comment campaign that opens up for 30 to 60 days after the rule is published in the Federal Register. Now, recently they had the tip-stealing campaign. Did you guys see this? It happened right before the omnibus spending bill was signed. Basically, the Department of Labor was proposing this rule that would allow employers to decide whether or not they want to give, say, waiters or cooks the tips that they are given by customers. So basically, you know, a waiter is still being paid $2.15, makes like $40 in tips, and the employer could actually keep that. That was the new proposed rule change. So a lot of like workers' rights and work justice advocates got together and they did this giant public comment campaign. It's similar to the one that John Oliver did really publicly on his show for net neutrality,
where
he created these micro websites where people could go and then it's automatically populated into regulations.gov. So the people in the tip stealing or the workers' advocates, they did something similar, and what they were able to do through all their comments and all the economic impact analysis that they submitted to OMB, the omnibus bill included language that would basically negate this entire rule change. So they were able to stop that from happening through the omnibus spending bill.
So it seems like public comments is definitely one method in battling this, but it also seems like this proposed rule is going to get hit with a flood of lawsuits. Because, you know, getting any official decision changed based on who your family members are or what your family members do is really, really hard to have a legal basis, a legal standing to do that.
Yeah, so one of the things that people are noticing actually is what they're calling the chilling effect. So you already have mothers that are dropping out of WIC. You already have parents that are taking those children out of CHIP, because not only do you have this rule that's been kind of cooking around for like a year, we don't know when it's coming out, but on top of that you have way more enforcement of like ICE. There was recently a raid in Tennessee where like 90 people were arrested. Some people were let go, but there are still a lot of people that are being detained. So a lot of immigrants are like, I don't want my name or information in any government database, so I'm just gonna take my child out of healthcare. And things that we need, like SNAP and like the nutritional programs that come with through WIC.
It's kind of like the hesitation to sign up for DACA after Trump canceled the program.
Absolutely.
This one, I think the fear is understandable, but I think it's a lot less. It's a lot less imminent than the ending of DACA. I mean, this proposed rule change is going to have to get seen by like a lot of lawyers and go through like a long court battle. And this one, it doesn't strike me that the president has as much leeway on this kind of rule change as they would about something like DACA.
One thing about OMB is that when a agency is proposing a rule change, if the rule change that they're proposing could potentially have a $100 million impact on the economy, it has to go through a designated in-depth economic analysis. The weird thing about all the drafts we've been seeing about the new rule is that they've been saying this will not reach that threshold. Mm-hmm. But you have places like the city of New York City that has a large immigrant population. They're like, that would be well above $100 million just for our city alone, let alone specific states or specific healthcare providers. Like, it's not just people dropping out of these programs, it's now emergency rooms now have way more people that are using their services instead of actually using healthcare and using preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to the hospital when they have an emergency, and you have nonprofits or foundations that supply these hospitals with emergency funds that now cannot meet the demand. So it reaches that. It's not just that, it's the amount of nutrition that are going to children and going to school, and how they've done studies that if a kid doesn't have enough nutrition, he's not going to be learning as well in like elementary school or middle school, and it could have like a really damaging ripple effect on the economy in general.
Well, I imagine, you know, you're talking about the impact to the city of New York. That's not going to impact the federal budget, that like $1 billion change. That's about the federal budget, right?
The funny thing is that one person is proposing that all the money that is going to be saved, quote, air quotes, by the federal government by not providing assistance to these families is actually going to go towards the wall in the South. So it's like paying for the wall with the money that immigrants are giving up. So it's almost as if Mexico is paying for the wall.
Not sure I could go quite that far.
that was just one observation from one reporter. That is a very wonky policy. And I bring it up just because it isn't like legislation. It isn't something you can see or hold tangibly in your hand or in schoolhouse rock. This is a really wonky way of making a substantial change in government that does not go through Congress at all.
I'm just a little skeptical, though. Like, DHS has a lot of lawyers, and I know they're concerned about civil rights and civil liberties to some degree, and that they're gonna...
With litigation, though, you have to have a plaintiff first. So it kind of has to go into effect, and someone has to get hurt before litigation can really start. So it could be a year after it's published, it could be 2 years after it's published. It just depends on what immigrant advocates see as, like, a case that actually proves that this was a damaging policy change, and so we're going to sue DHS over it.
Could someone who's been, like, who's had a child on SNAP or something sue immediately if the rule works retroactively, saying all the time that you've been using this program is already going to affect your ability to sponsor a relative?
I'm not a legal expert, but I would assume that sponsorship of like a husband would have to damages have to have already taken place. Mm-hmm. So sponsorship of say a husband or a child would already have to have been part of this.
All right. Well, good to know. That'll do for Below the Fold. Thank you, Eli. Thank you, Kat. It's been a wonderful discussion. And thank you, listener, for joining us on Wonkcast.
Thanks for coming to GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @GWWonkcast. Send us love letters and hate mail. Email us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher. Our editors are Eric Ledoux and Eli Richmond, with music by Pele Gunther.